the Rise Up See Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up See Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. I'm your host, Jess Root from CardsWire.com, the USA Today NFL wire site, covering, of course, your Arizona Cardinals. With me in episode 503, it's our review show, is Seth Cox from RevengeOfTheBirds.com, Arizona Cardinals site for SB Nation, and also one of the hosts of the original Draft Breakdown podcast as the bowl season is wrapping up and we hit the offseason. In the NFL, now is as good a time as any to jump on and start listening to that show. The regular shows, the free shows, and even get the bonus content as that comes out, $2 a month for the extra show, the bonus show that they do, and then $4 a month gets you also the premium written content that they add as well, which is, that's really good content this off season, especially when we hit an off season like this where the Cardinals are going to be, you know, big players in this year's draft, but that's not what that show is about. We're recording on a Tuesday night after the Cardinals. I said if there was going to be a game where they'd F around and win, it would be against the Eagles, and lo and behold, they F'd around and they won handily. This was not a fluky win. This was a 35-31 game where the Cardinals beat the Philadelphia Eagles on the road, and it was a game in which they were down... they were down 15 points at halftime, and yeah, it should have been, they played and got the comeback win, but they dominated offensively from start to finish. It was something we have, like, the Cowboys game was surprising. This one was shocking because it's against the NFC champions. Now, we detailed how the Eagles had struggled defensively, but the Cardinals did something amazing in the fact they mitigated their problems on defense by never giving them the ball. Almost 40 minutes of time of possession, they just simply absolutely demoralized that Philly defense.
Yeah, that was something that you and I discussed, and we knew that was had to be the game plan if they were gonna have a chance to win this game. I don't think you and I in our wildest dreams could have seen it going as effectively as it did, though.
Oh no, like the entire time I thought best case scenario would be a competitive blowout. Like I thought 37-24, you know, Glenn Irby over at Eagles Wire said 41-31. The belief was that the Eagles were going to do whatever they want to offensively and that the Cardinals would kind of keep pace.
Yeah, and to be fair, for the most part, they did. I mean, let's be honest. They really didn't struggle to move the ball when they had the ball, but the Cardinals did a couple of things. One, obviously, you look at it, the Eagles had 7 drives. They punted twice. And ironically, they punted the first possession of each punt. You know, obviously to start the game and then to start the second half in the third quarter when they got the ball back for the first time. And those were kind of just enough. The Cardinals didn't punt at all. Again, not a sentiment we would ever have expected to whisper on this show. But I mean, to see it work, right? You had the Eagles go 3 and out and the Cardinals go 64 yards in 7, almost 8 minutes of game time. And then they kick a field goal.
And they ran into issues is that, and I wrote about this right after the first half, is that while the score was bad, the score was bad at halftime. The Cardinals had completely, their offensive performance, they were dominating, but they got behind the 6 on that first drive. They had the turnover on the second drive. It's just they shot themselves in the foot. on three different possessions.
And so there was a something, and I have not fact checked this, and quite frankly, I'm not going to fact check this, but this is was put in the Revenge of the Birds comment section. And we're going to discuss the need, you know, a little later probably to in this episode. But when Kyler Murray has played with DeAndre Hopkins, and again, I haven't fact-checked this or anything, so if this is way off, I apologize. But Kyler Murray's played 31 games with DeAndre Hopkins, 32 games without DeAndre Hopkins in his career. And there's really two numbers that stand out, okay? Just under 7,500 passing yards in those 32 games without DeAndre Hopkins. Just over 7,650 with DeAndre Hopkins. So 150, 160 yards more passing in one less game. So not a huge number, right? Like that's not crazy. The crazy number is, and it really showed up in the first half, but the crazy number is 37 touchdowns in 32 games without DeAndre Hopkins. 53 touchdowns in 31 games with DeAndre Hopkins. And that got me thinking of just about Kyler's stats in general. And one of the things that, you know, people bring up is that he doesn't throw a lot of touchdowns. Now, you and I have logically explain that, you know, he does rush for a number of touchdowns and they're able to run the ball effectively. James Conner, before that it was Kenyon Drake or whoever it was back in the day, along with Kyler rushing for 10 or more touchdowns, you know, those things happening. But then I was thinking about it. Doesn't that kind of say a lot about Kyler, the passer in that situation? When you're saying like there's really no difference between the 20s with who his wide receivers are. He's going to be productive in between the 20s. It's just that when they don't have the guy that commands the attention, when they don't have a Larry Fitzgerald kind of turning back the clock in 2019, right? And then obviously the two excellent seasons with DeAndre Hopkins, It makes things, and I mean, kind of a duh sentiment to have, but it makes things more difficult, right? When you get in the red zone, like who is going to score the touchdowns? And you go back, you know, in 2019, his rookie year, David Johnson, 4 receiving touchdowns, Larry Fitzgerald, 4, Christian Kirk, 3. And then you go to that 2020 season. And, you know, he's starting to become one of the better guys in the NFL. And it's not just DeAndre, right? It's not just Hopkins scoring 6, but Christian Kirk, career high at the time, 6. Chase Edmonds, 4. Dan Arnold, 4. Like, all of a sudden, I mean, that's 20 touchdowns between 4 players right there. And then obviously the 2021 season, we know how that was going and how effective that was going before the injuries and kind of the falling off the cliff happened. But I mean, DeAndre had 8 and Christian had 5, and then James Conner had 3, Zach Ertz had 3, AJ Green had 3, Antoine Wesley had 3. But remember, Zach Ertz had 15 rushing touchdowns that season.
James Conner, not Zach Ertz.
James Conner had 15 rushing touchdowns that season. You know, the season before, Kyler Murray had 11, Kenyon Drake had 10. So, like, when you're getting 20 touchdowns rushing from two players, which they did in back-to-back seasons, 20 or more, you know, like I said, James Conner, 15, Kyler Murray, 5 in 2021, and then 10 and 11. Like, all of a sudden, you don't need to throw for touchdowns as well, right? Because you're scoring, so it's not a big deal.
Oh, right. But, and something that people don't look at. They they overlook this, is the fact that if you have a quarterback of his caliber, he's also, it lends itself to the type of player, of an unselfish player he is, he doesn't give two flips about whether they get the end zone, whether he throws for a touchdown or whether they run for attention. He just wants the touchdown. He wants the touchdown.
Well, and you look at their offensive statistics, and again, we can take 2019 out of it. He was a rookie, but it kind of goes to what I'm saying, 25th in passing touchdowns, but 7th in rushing. Again, 7th in the NFL in rushing in 2019 when they were ostensibly not a good team, right? And then 2020, you move up slightly, you go to 13, and you go to 4th in rushing touchdowns. Again, that's insane, right? Like, you're still kind of working out the kinks. You're a 500 team, but like, you're that good. And then you get to 12th and 3rd. And so like, it's never like they were bad at scoring touchdowns. It's just that they do a lot of it on the ground, right?
Yeah,
And that's just, like you said, for a quarterback, it's not as sexy.
But that's where, in this game, that's where this was exciting, because now in the last two games, he's got 5 touchdown passes. In the second half in particular, 13 of 14 passing for over 130, I think it was 133 yards and all 3 touchdowns. He had more touchdowns than incompletions in the second half. He was rolling. And even in the first half, like, there was so much to like offensively.
Yeah, they just didn't finish.
They didn't finish early on, and I will say this: I did my studs and duds articles, you do winners and losers. I do studs and duds, and there were no duds. There were no duds because the defense wasn't on the field long enough for anyone to have a bad performance. And offensively, they had really good performances. Kyler played like a stud. Connor was fantastic. You got Michael Wilson bouncing back. Trey McBride was good. Greg Dortch was fantastic. Michael Carter stepped up and had a really good game. And you look at how the playing time goes, and, you know, Amari DiMercato barely played. But what that playing time, that indicated two things. One, they were on schedule offensively because DiMercato plays as a third down back. He comes in for those clear passing downs. And so if he's only getting 9 snaps out of their 76, that means they were on schedule. They were not in panic mode, even though, like, in the first half, you know, they got down, you know, multiple scores. They didn't panic.
They were still kind of just running the ball.
What I love about the end of the game, or actually it's more than anything, it was the comment by Jonathan Gannon. And I will say this, I was shocked by the onside kick, but I thought maybe initially that it was my son-in-law, in fact, say, hey, did they do that so that they would have time? I'm like, it was probably just they had a look and they had a surprise. No. My son-in-law was completely right. Gannon, after the game, explained the strategic nature of that. So they saw it as one of two things. They either get the ball back, go up to, you know, score the winning score, and take care of him thin air, or they gave them a short field and they said he trusted his defense to force a field goal and then they would have time. And this is where Gannon is talking, and we're going to talk more about this later. Gannon has become a big Kyler Murray fan. He's treating Kyler like, you know, Patrick Mahomes, like Andy Reid treats Patrick Mahomes. You're like, just get the ball in his hand and they're going to let him do his thing. And that is, you know, he's looking like that franchise guy. His numbers weren't eye-popping, but he had control of everything. They looked fantastic. The offense was just so, so good. And
well, here, let me give you something crazy about that last drive. They didn't get to third down once. They were never in a third down scenario, which is kind of baffling with how this offense is gone almost all season, right? Like, they seemingly always put themselves in, and it's not that it's third and long, but they've seemingly always put themselves in a position where it seemed like, it's third and you know, third and six. All right. Do you go for all of it or do you get it to fourth and two, fourth and one? And we know how bad they are going for it on fourth down, right? So, like, what do you do? And like you said, it wasn't eye-popping numbers. Now, the last drive was eye-popping, let's be honest. That was spectacular. But it was the fact that, like, you get the ball, it's first and 10, you run the ball, maybe inexplicably, but I think they were trying to get to the two-minute warning. Like, that's what I kind of took it as, is that they got it to 204, and then they snapped the ball again. And they were like, okay, we're going to get this to the two-minute warning and then kind of figure everything out on the other side. And they just happened to get a 12-yard pass to Rondale Moore. But, you know, first and 10, second and 9, first and 10, second and 4, first and 10, first and 5, and then, you know, second and goal, first and 5 from the 5. So first and goal, second and goal. Like, that's just, like you said, that is a franchise-esque type of drive. That's not where you're never in fourth and game situation.
Right. They weren't in desperation like against Houston. Like when right. they were when that drive when they were trying to come back and get the winning drive against Houston, and they were their backs were against the wall, and they were, you know, he was chucking, hopefully something happens. This was control. They were under control, and the trust. And here's the question I have. It's kind of what I wanted to do. So was the win a good thing? Now we're going to talk about the draft situation. I believe, now we're going to lament, maybe we lose out on Marvin Harrison Jr. However, you can't miss. So this is definitely not an analytic thing. This is not something from analytics. This is an intangible football thing. How you're getting your franchise quarterback looking like a franchise quarterback, and you have a big time win at the end of the season in which it wasn't a fluky win. That's the thing. This was not a game where it was fluky, and this is a game they dominated from start to finish offensively and overcame adversity in the first half. And the value of this type of win in terms of the belief system that the locker room has, I don't know if you can put a price or a quantitative value on that. It's reminiscent to me of the way the Cardinals played at the end of 2013 for that first season, Bruce Arians. They finally started believing. Now, they are not on the same level as that team, but that's the sort of win when you have that sort of performance that really kind of propels the belief into the off season.
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to you feel like you've made the right decision. And there are two, that's a twofold thing for this franchise right now. And obviously it's simple, right? We don't know if they've made the right decision. We won't know if they've made the right decision for at least next year. And you know, you look at the Philadelphia Eagles, like there's genuine questions about whether they've made the right decision with Nick Sirianni and you know, Jalen Hurts and all of these things. And so when you look at it, you're looking for, we want to see that we're headed in the right direction. We do this, you know, we do the Reacts polls every week, and it's obviously always better after a win, right? Like the belief in the direction of the team is always, always better after a win. But that being said, when you look at it and you see that this team had lost a game to the Chicago Bears, that a lot of fans, you and I included, thought was a winnable game. And then you kind of go through the season and you look at the weeks where it was bad, right? And the weeks that it was bad, Houston, LA, after the LA loss, it was the lowest point in the season in terms of belief in the direction of the team. But then, man, the next week, whew, that thing spiked up real quick, right? Because you beat Pittsburgh handily on the road. He had a slight dip after San Francisco, but I mean, is anybody really surprised by that, right? Like, nobody was expecting to beat that. But then that loss to the Bears, it really was kind of the, maybe they're just not, maybe this isn't right. Maybe Gannon's not the right guy, or his overall belief in Kyler is not the right thing. And then you come out and win this, and we haven't got the results this week. We'll get those at the end of the week. But, and they were at 69% confident in the direction the team was headed, you know, going into this game. I'm going to guess, I'll wager it's going to be in the 80s at least, if not kissing the 90s, because that's a season defining win. And people can make fun of that and go, oh yeah, you're a 4-12 team. Of course, that's season defining. But you know, you and I have talked about this. Kyler's won as many games this year as he did last year. He's 3-4. He was 3-8 last year. And what most people considered a down season for him, right? Like a down season, 66% completion percentage, just under 2,400 yards, 14 touchdowns, 7 interceptions. Rushing numbers were good. Things like that, right? Like all of that. And people are like, oh, he had a bad year, you know, a bad season. And then you look at this year, and he's on much better pace, but he's already won 3 games. And as much as people hate the idea that quarterback wins or QB wins is a stat, it is, because it changes how people feel about a player objectively. You're always going to have the Kirk Cousins and Justin Herberts, right? Like, you're always going to have those guys who are the Kirk Cousins who all he does is win and put up massive numbers and everybody wants to replace him. And then you're going to have the Justin Herbert who seems to lose a lot and puts up massive numbers. You're going to have those guys. But for the most part, if you don't win as a quarterback, people don't believe in you or think that you're the guy. They want to find the guy. And so if the Cardinals end up going 3-5, or God forbid 4-4, and then we can look back, right, too, and we can go, oh, Houston, should have won that game, right?
Giants.
Right. Well, I'm just talking about the Kyler wins. Yeah. And you're saying, like, man, they could have been 5-3 with Kyler, you know, 5-3, or if they – if the defense does anything right against Chicago early, they could have been 6-2 with, like, then there's really no question. But even with this team, with this roster, 3-5, you know, saying that they lose next week, 3-5, changing the perception, winning games over, again, let's not be unrealistic, a bad 7-9 Falcons team. How they're 7-9, Jess and I cannot figure out, you know, a bad 9-win Steelers team. And let's be honest, not a great 11, and who says that, right? But not a great 11-win Philly team. But the teams that they beat, that Kyler has beat, are 20, they have 27 wins. Like, that's super impressive, man. Like, for a team that everybody wants to move on from the guy because he doesn't win enough, but without him the last 2 seasons, you've won 2 games.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, you know, and again, you can say what you want about last season, but this season, to come out, win 3 games with this roster. And by the way, he's got 2 fourth quarter comebacks and 2 game winning drives this season.
That's more than anything else. Those are 2 things that you can hang your head that Jonathan Gannon is starting to believe that he's the guy, and Gannon already believed in him, but now we're seeing it again. So in 2 of the 3 wins, they rallied. And not only that, but Kyler, not only they had to rally back from significantly down in the first half. They came back from 2 scores down. The Falcons game, they had the clutch, you know, last drive there, and they did it again. They caught up against Philly, gave up a go-ahead score and then came down and got the winning score. It's just, now, I want to ask you this. Is how much, because this is where Cardinals fans are a little bit conflicted, how much were you when they got the, especially when they got down inside the 10, you were hoping that they would go for overtime and then lose in overtime? Because the way they were playing was already a win to me, like for what our purposes are for the development of the franchise, you know, draft pick, draft status. I felt myself, now, did I feel, I was overjoyed with the win. But at the same time, I was like, couldn't they have just, you know, tied the score and lost in overtime? That I didn't have that going through my head. That was the conversation with me and my son and my son-in-law when we were watching the game on Sunday.
Yeah, but I mean, you also mentioned it earlier, right? There's literally, just literally not a, there's just not anything that overcomes or changes a winning culture. And that's where this overwhelmingly is more important than the opportunity to draft Mark, or I guarantee is a very strong word, but because unless you're drafting first, right, there's no guarantee, but to have a great opportunity to draft Marvin Harrison Jr. But with this team, and to be fair, with, again, something that you and I talked about on the show, the best wide receiver draft class I can remember in the last decade since 2014, like, guys like Malik Nabers and Rome Odunze, who put on a show last night, these dudes are legitimate, like, wide receiver ones in most draft classes. They just happen to be in the draft class with Calvin Johnson, right? Like, it's like, oh, well, maybe we don't get Calvin Johnson. Maybe we don't get the guy who ends up being the freakiest of freaks in the history of the NFL, right? But on the flip side, maybe you get another really good wide receiver, right? Maybe you get a guy that ends up being incredibly talented and gives you a great career. And that would be okay. Yeah, so you don't get the next Larry. You don't get the next Calvin Johnson, where these guys just put up massive numbers forever. At the same time, it's not like that means that you won't get a good player. And the flip side to that, the other side of that coin is, you need a little bit of everything outside of maybe quarterback and maybe safety. So, you know, now maybe your options are a little wider. You know, do you want to take wide receiver two or tackle one, or do you want to take the best defensive player in the draft? Because God knows that defense needs as much help as it can possibly get.
We're going to talk about in the offseason, like, running back, pretty, they're pretty okay. Quarterback, they're pretty okay. Tight end, yeah, you like where tight end is. Safety, okay. Everywhere else, literally, just talent. Give talent everywhere.
Right. Well, and the crazy thing is, too, and this is what should excite people, okay? Obviously, this regime did not draft Trey McBride, but this coaching staff has gotten the most out of Trey McBride. However, this regime made it a priority to go get Elijah Higgins. And boy, does Elijah Higgins look like a guy that can play in the NFL. Yeah. Man, after that terrible drop in the Houston game, right? Like, all of a sudden you're like, hey, this Elijah Higgins guy is not too bad. You know, and again, this, like, regime.
He can be Dan Arnold without the expectations of Dan Arnold.
Right, exactly. You know, this regime didn't go get Greg Dortch, but man, this regime sure knows how to use Greg Dortch in a good way. And so I think that right there, I and let's be honest, I mean, a lot of it is just PTSD, right? Like, we as fans, especially you and I, have watched enough Arizona Cardinals football to be like, oh man, just get the second pick so you don't screw it up, right? Like, just don't give yourself the chance to screw it up and pick the wrong guy. And, you know, like, just go get the sure thing. Like, when you have a chance to get Marvin Harrison Jr., whew, that makes it a lot easier because you can't screw up Marvin Harrison Jr., right?
Well, and here's the thing. Does this not sound almost like, if we take it back here, is this almost like the exact conversation we were having about Will Anderson?
It was. And by the way, Will Anderson, complete freak. Like,
well, and it's like we said, just draft Will Anderson. He's a home run pick. But somehow they managed to manage it in a way where they still got a player. Like, do you know what? So Hollywood Brown was live tweeting the game because obviously he's hurt. But do you know what they call Paris Johnson, or at least what Hollywood calls him?
No, what?
All-Pro P.
Oh, nice. Yeah, and
they all see a great player in the making in Paris Johnson.
Well, you know what's really fun about that, Jess, and this goes to what you're saying. What's really fun about that is, like, this dude is literally, he played four snaps at right tackle at Ohio State. He played right. He played a ton of snaps at right guard. He played a ton of snaps at left guard. Played a ton of snaps at left tackle. But he played four snaps at right tackle at Ohio State. So he basically has never played right tackle, and he's literally looking like a guy that is a future All-Pro right tackle. And so that just opens things up, right? Just like, all right, you're sitting at four and Marvin Harrison Jr. falls to you. Okay. Nobody's going to be like, oh, you know, like, what's the dilemma? No, you at that point, you just take the best player in the draft at a huge position of need, right? Like, it's tailor-made. But let's say, you know, and we'll talk about it, but like all offseason, obviously. But, you know, let's say the Bears make that move and they go down to three, right? And so the Patriots go up, they get the guy they want, and then the Commanders take another quarterback. And so now you're sitting at three, and the Bears are going to be like, hey, we're sticking with Justin Fields. We're going to go get Marvin Harrison Jr. So now you're the Cardinals. You say, okay, we're open for business. Come get Jaden Daniels. Maybe there's, you know, now with how Michael Penix has been playing, like, maybe there's this market for Michael Penix. Who knows? But you come get QB3, right, at number four. And, you know, we talked about this the other day, but, like, at five, six, probably not six, but five, seven, nine, and you say, okay, we have Malik Nabers, we have Rome Odunze, we have Joe Alt, and we have Olamanu Fashanu, and then you've got whoever you want to put it as defensive player one. Again, defensive player one, not edge, not tackle, not corner. No, defensive player one are all on the board. So you can go down to nine and just sit there and be like, whoever falls to me, that's who I'm taking. Because it doesn't, I mean, hell, you could pick Brock Bowers, who some people think's one of the best players in the draft. Like, you are just setting yourself up for that. And so, like I talked about last week, getting that second pick was big because you kind of controlled the draft, right? Like, you could make the pick for Marvin Harrison if you wanted it, or you can get a king's ransom. But at four, you still have those same options. The only thing you don't probably have is the option about Marvin Harrison. But if Marvin Harrison goes in the top three, and people grade out Jaden Daniels as the rumors are starting to percolate that they're talking about him in that capacity, then everything else is on the board, right? So if MHG goes in the first three picks, then you can make that move at four however you want to. Oh, you want Jaden Daniels? Okay, give me everything you got, right? Or another team moves up, and the Bears make a double trade down, something that's not out of this realm of possibility, right? Because they're going to stick with Justin Fields. And now MHG's at four. That, then again, you're on the decision-making. You're not going to trade unless you're making a move like you did with Will Anderson last year, where you're like, look, we'll forego Will Anderson to get a one next year. Now, at some point, you need to cash in on those lottery tickets, right? Like, you need to stop buying more lottery tickets and cash in. But it still is that option, but I don't think it completely changes everything, especially with how the rumors are going with Jaden Daniels. I think that's the big key right now, because if you go to like mock draft database, and this is one of the bigger issues with the website itself, not a knock on them, they do a fantastic job, but you know, it's just data. They just input data. But if you go to mock draft database, Marvin Harrison Jr. is not in the first round. And the reason why is because there's no consensus on where he's going now. But the consensus top three right now, Caleb Williams, Drake May, Jaden Daniels. So at four, you literally are open for business, or you take the best player in the draft. That's not a bad position to be in if you're the Cardinals. And you won a game.
Yeah, totally. Let's talk more about that. Coming up next on the Rise of Syria podcast, Mr. Cardinal Stock. Let's talk about their draft status, where they're standing now, what we need to see happen in Week 18. That's coming up next on Rise of Syria. We're back on the Rise of Syria podcast, Mr. Cardinal Stock on the web. That wonderful work that the Cardinals did in Week 16 to end up with the number two pick in the draft and you know, the Patriots winning that game against the Bucks, I mean, against the Broncos, all for naught, because the Cardinals went and won their fourth game, tying them with the Washington Commanders and New England Patriots, thus making them the fourth pick in the draft. And so you go into Week 18, they can finish, best case scenario, number two. Worst case scenario would be number seven. And the first thing, and we'll talk about this on the preview show, is, you know, as much as I thought that the Cardinals were going to get, would be dominated by Seattle, I'm looking at Seattle's last several games, and the strength that they had in their rush defense early in the season is gone. And to see what Pittsburgh did to them over the weekend, and what the Cardinals have done over the last few weeks with the run game, that Seahawks game is very winnable. And so you could be looking at a fifth win, which if they do win a fifth game, then you're in the territory of the Titans and the Chargers and the Giants, all of whom all have five wins. And you look at
this, and are all complete wild cards about what they're going to do as well.
Right. You look at the Titans are going to host the Jaguars. I don't know. I mean, the Jaguars need that game to win the title, to win the division title. Okay. They need that game. So they're going to be locked in. So Titans, you know, you can't expect them to win. The Chargers are at home against the Chiefs. The Chargers have basically, you know, mailed in their season. And then the Giants host the Eagles. Now, I think of all those three five-win games, I think the Giants game is the most likely to have an upset because, you know, the Eagles' defense isn't good right now. And the Giants have been, with Tyrod Taylor, surprisingly competitive. But, you know, it would work out if the Cardinals win, then you'd hope that at least one of those three teams would win as well, so they don't go for this space of 2 weeks from the second pick to the seventh pick. Not that the seventh pick is a bad spot to be, but you take away a little bit less of your flexibility.
It does change a lot, and so there's two scenarios that we need to watch. Obviously, the first one is the Cardinals, but there's a couple scenarios that we need to watch. Number two, the big one, the Houston Texans. They're currently picking 17th, so that pick folds to the Cardinals, right?
Go Colts, because yeah. If the Texans win postseason, they're in. They win, they're in.
Yeah, it's as simple as that for them. So a couple games we need to watch is obviously, this Seattle game is a double-edged sword, because Seattle is at 8-8. If Seattle wins, they go to 9-8, and that'll push Houston, theoretically Houston losing in this scenario, that'll push Houston down. Cincinnati is 8-8. They get the Cleveland Browns. I don't see them winning that game. So we're still sitting at, you know, best case scenario, Cardinals lose, Texans lose now, or Cardinals lose, Texans lose, Seattle moves up, Houston's down to 16. So now you're at, let's just say for easy math, 4-16. The next one's, you know, Denver. I don't know what Denver's doing. Does anybody know what Denver's doing?
And the same thing with the Raiders. It's
right.
They're sitting at 7-9 now. I was sweating that game as one of my underdog picks because I thought they would beat the Colts. And
I did too.
They got down 23-3. I'm like, dang. But they came back and covered. It was +3.5. They lose by 3. Thank you, Raiders.
Well, and what's crazy about the Raiders, and it's so much, it kind of goes to what we're talking about with earlier with Kyler, right? Vibes are such a thing. If I told you that Antonio Pierce has only won one more game than Josh McDaniels, you'd be like, what? But McDaniels was 3-5, and Pierce is 4-4. But aren't the vibes completely different, right? Yes. Like you're like, oh, wait a second. I thought they were terrible. That's what everybody told me. But, you know, again, sometimes vibes are more important than anything else. The Saints are somehow, some way.
They could win their freaking division.
Right. They're either in the division or not in the playoffs. They take on the Falcons. So that is a game, again, assuming Houston loses to Indianapolis, that's a game that can get you up. So now a Seahawks win, a Saints win, and that coin flip of Denver, but let's say a Denver win, that gets you to 14. Again, I don't think the Bengals are going to win that game. I'm not going to say there's no chance, but it feels very no chances, right? Like it feels very like it's not going to happen. So I think the highest you can look at is 14. So obviously if the Cardinals beat the Seahawks, now you're at 15. So you go from 17 to 15 with that Texans pick. And then that becomes the, like, okay, how do you want to play that? Like, do you want to have the ammunition that if you fall down to 7 with a win, you have some ammunition to move up, right? So now 7-15 probably gets you to 4 if you need to go up there to get, if you really want Marvin Harrison Jr., if you're like, we got to have this guy. But, you know, 7, I listed the names. Obviously, everything's got to actually happen before we can, you know what's happening. But again, you go off the big board, right? You just the big board itself. Marvin Harrison Jr., obviously, no-brainer. Everybody's going to jump on that. Malik Nabers, I don't think you and I have any issues if that's where they end up going, right? Brock, so that's two players. Sorry, that's two players. Brock Bowers, I think, out of the guys that are the guys, Bowers is probably my least, like the last guy I would take. I don't know how you feel, but that's how I feel. Olufoshanu, right? So now that we're at 3, Olufoshanu, great left tackle prospect. Okay. Joe Alt, my personal offensive tackle prospect 1, great tackle prospect. So we're at 4 guys. Romo Dunze, I think he's going to go to top 10. I think he is basically a lock. He's a phenomenal player. Kind of everything the Cardinals need in a wide receiver, right? Like not a bad spot, not a bad fit. So that's 5 guys. And then obviously the last one would be the defensive end out of, or the edge player out of UCLA and Latu, you know, so that's 6 guys. All right. So getting to 7, while now you're kind of beholden to the other teams in front of you, there's still 6 guys that I can walk out of that top 7 from and just feel like I hit a home run. That, I mean, A+ draft from the get-go. And by the way, all positions of need too, right? Like every single one of those guys, you're like, got a great player out of position. Like you don't feel like in this instance where you're going, all right, should we take, you know, the fourth guy at this position, or should we take a inside line? You know, like you feel like, hey, we're getting a bedrock player at a position of need on a team that lacks talent at these positions. Like that's a home run. And so, yeah, obviously, as we've highlighted earlier, we're always going to cheer for wins first off.
Yes.
But
if they're going to lose, this is the time to do it. And I still think that if they lose this weekend, I think the number three pick is very, very, very possible. Because the Patriots are hosting the Jets.
Right.
The Patriots don't lose to the Jets.
Yeah, and that's, you know,
the Commanders beating the Cowboys, I think, is highly, highly unlikely, especially since Dallas is staring down a division title.
Right, thanks to your Arizona Cardinals.
Yeah.
Let's just be honest. The game that cost the Cardinals the chance to draft top three was the Commanders not completing the comeback against the Jets 2 weeks ago. If the Commanders win that game, the win doesn't matter, right? You're still sitting at three. It's locked in. It is what it is. And then you still, like you said, have a chance to go to two with a win, man. That would have been crazy, right? But the Commanders are going to move on from Ron Rivera. They're a crap show for a reason.
And they're probably moving on from Sam Howell.
I mean, they can't not. It can't be probably at this point. Like they just got to. Like it's got to be over, man.
Right.
Like you can't bench a guy
and reluctantly start him again after Jacoby Brissett. I heard a funny meme about, I saw a funny meme about this, is like they named Jacoby Brissett the starter, and then he sees the 49ers defense, and then he goes, nope, the hammy during midweek of the week.
I know, right? That's so true, too. Poor guy. You know, and I'm looking at it, and like I said, we're going to get into these prospects. Like, it's going to happen. We're going to spend months and months. We're going to spend more time on the prospects than we are the free agents, which happened first. Like, that's just how, one, because the pool is so much bigger, but two, you know, it's to be fair and to be completely open, one, it's easier to talk about, and two, it drives clicks. People love the conversation. Like, when Jess and I start talking about the 31-year-old free agent left guard, people are going to be like, yeah, next. But when we talk about
the fourth round prospects, the deep cut, the small school fourth round center, they're like, yeah, we want to know about him.
Yeah, the guy that's going to be the 31-year-old free agent in 7 years, and you're going to be like, why are you spending so much time on this guy? but you know, just to bring up the name one last time, because I feel like the consensus 1-2 at wide receivers, obviously, consensus one is Marvin Harrison. It feels like the consensus two, my number two as well, Malik Nabers, phenomenal player, going to get Justin Jefferson comps, rightfully so. He is a freak of nature. Has a lot of Jefferson in his game. But I'm telling you what, man, the more I watch of Roma Dunze, the more I got, you know, to know his game. Obviously last night was just huge, but he really fits the bill of what they need as a wide receiver one, just as much of as a Marvin Harrison. And that's not to take away anything from Marvin Harrison. You know, one of the best prospects I've ever seen. But I mean, this guy, Roma Dunze, is listed at 6'3 and 205 pounds. He's probably going to come in at 6'2 and probably 200 pounds, which is not bad, right? Like that's still a big target, but you're talking about a guy the last 2 years at Washington, over 1100 yards last year, 7 touchdowns, and then over 1500 yards and 13 touchdowns this year. So another big body, long-armed, elite downfield and outside weapon. Maybe a better fit, if that makes sense. Maybe a better fit for what the Cardinals and Kyler Murray especially need at that X receiver position. You know, kind of a souped up version of Michael Wilson, if you will. And Odunze is going to get comps thrown out all over the place. I haven't done enough digging into his athletic testing to give you something I'm comfortable with yet. But like, if he measures in over 6'2 and 200 pounds, like, you're not going to hear, again, just like last year, where we were like, Will Anderson Jr. is the best player in the draft. I'm going to, before this whole process even starts, Marvin Harrison Jr. is the best player in the 2024 draft. There's not a doubt in my being that he is the best player. However, Rome Odunze is not as far off as people think. And where last year Will Anderson didn't have an equal as an edge rusher, you know, Marvin Harrison has elite company right behind him. And that's what the difference is in this situation. You know, if you're able to pick from a coin flip for most people, left tackle, or, you know, a guy in Neighbors or Odunze who fit the bill of what the Cardinals need at wide receiver, like those are winning opportunities that you just don't see very often. So again, we're never going to lament a win, but I think it's less of an issue this season, especially, like, not to throw shade or anything like that, but there's not going to be a Derek Brown who's turned into a nice player, by the way, a nice player, not probably not worth where he went, but a good enough player. And, or an Isaiah Simmons in this situation where you're going to be like, oh, they just didn't have the chance to pick that guy, right? I think any of these guys are going to be very, very good pros for a long time.
Coming up next on the Rise of Syria podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the web, let's move on to the final segment where we talk about what Jonathan Gannon said about Kyler Murray. That's coming up next on Rise of Syria. We're back on the Rise of Syria podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the web. You can't always believe what a head coach says. And apparently, if you're Josh Dobbs, you also can't believe what Jonathan Gannon says. If you recall the story about Josh Dobbs, how they told him, hey, you're not going to get traded. We still like you for next year. And then immediately the next day, you're getting traded. But on the radio, and I think you and I have felt that this was always going to be the case, that as much as the narrative was coming into this offseason and into this season, the Cardinals were never planning on moving off of Kyler Murray. That was never in the plans because the organization believes in him. The coaching staff, Jonathan Gannon, took the job. He was a huge Kyler Murray fan to begin with, and everything he's seen about Kyler suggests that he's a guy that he wants to lead the team. This is the answer that Gannon gave on Burns and Gambo on Tuesday in his interview on Arizona Sports. And he was asked, John Gambadoro asked him, is there any doubt in your mind who your quarterback is going to be next season? He says, there's no doubt. I love that guy. It's not about one guy, but you know I'm a Kyler guy. Being here for a year with him now, I'm more convicted than when I got here. Just going through the process and our connection and developed a relationship with him and it being a little odd. You got your franchise quarterback and you know he can't play. Just seeing the work he put in and the things that we talked about in the offseason and what he wanted to improve on, what I wanted to see him improve on, I wanted to make sure that stayed strong. He's done everything we ask. I feel like what he's done, the work he's put in to get to this point, the play that type of football that he has in wins or losses coming off a knee injury in a new system, the competitor is, I've been very pleased with him. And the fact that he treated Kyler like he didn't protect his offense by, and even kind of, you know, when he does the onside kick, he's saying, I want the offense to have the ball again. One, I believe in my quarterback. I believe my eyes the entire game. And what we're seeing is that we knew Jonathan Gannon was a huge Kyler Murray fan to begin with. And it's been as I felt would happen. Kyler has taken to the hard coaching and the demands of Jonathan Gannon. I feel that that was the one thing. I think that was the thing that Cliff Kingsbury did the least well, was getting the most out of Kyler, because I always felt that he was just finally happy to have him and was content to say, my guy's a star, Kyler, do your thing, rather than saying, Kyler, we expect this, this, and this from you. And then Kyler has always responded to hard coaching, and he's gotten it this year, and he's responding. I don't think, like, for me, there was never a doubt that the plan was never move on from Kyler Murray. It was always built around him. And I think the way that he's played since his return suggests nothing short of that.
Well, I think a lot of it, and I'm interested in your take in this situation. I think a lot of it is that, and we'll never get the true story, but there was always this odd feeling that there was a battle between the front office and Kyler Murray, which is odd because whether or not people agree or disagree with the contract that Kyler received, Kyler also got Jonathan Gannon and Steve Keim extensions, right? Or sorry,
that is Cliff Kingsbury.
Cliff Kingsbury and Steve Keim. I've told you before, I truly think, based on people I've spoken to, that Cliff was always kind of like the intermediary, but also was never one to really get involved. He was just kind of like, hey, you guys figure it out. You guys are both adults and stuff like that. Like, I'm not taking a side in this, or you know, we're just all here to play football. I'm going to try to win football games. And then it got worse, right? With whatever the leaks were, whoever the leaks were coming from. And then you get this group, Monty and Jonathan Gannon, and it just feels like sometimes there just needs to be honest belief in a guy. And whether or not you truly believe in a guy is neither here nor there, right? But it feels like that Gannon always publicly, always is basically giving praise or compliments or giving Kyler Murray reassurance that, hey, you're our guy. We've got your back. You're our guy. And Cliff did that. Don't get me wrong. I mean, Cliff was probably even a bigger fan of Murray than Gannon was or is, right? Like, but at the same time, it feels like, and this is something we've heard from a number of people inside the building, especially players, is that there feels like there's some actual accountability. And to your point, Gannon's requirement or desire for accountability and work ethic has fed into Kyler Murray's as well, and really tapped, and God forbid, and I don't ever, you know, mean this in a negative way, but like maybe that injury needed to happen for him to mature as well, right? To see, because from what you
true adversity,
heard,
true adversity that he has, right, to buckle down and do more. Like, there's still things about this game that I wish he did a little bit better, but he did really lock in with this. Like, you know, Cliff, there was Larry Fitzgerald would never say that he said it, but he apparently talked about it to other veteran players. It was, I believe it was former Packers receiver James Jones that came out as a reporter, as an analyst on TV, and spoke about what Fitzgerald was frustrated about, the way they rolled out the red carpet and basically just said, Kyler here, rather than making him earn it. And so there was a level of, they create a level of entitlement, of expectation, where he kind of ran the show when he hadn't done anything. And we did hear other concepts, and this came from Larry Fitzgerald as well on a Monday Night Football pregame show, that perhaps the suggestion that Kyler in the meeting room would try to be, or come off as trying to be, the smartest in the room. And we sort of suggested that based on what we saw from his play, that he didn't necessarily believe in the plan, per the game plans exactly, that Cliff Kingsbury put together, because he had the freedom at the line of scrimmage to change things. It would often change things, as opposed to Colt McCoy, who took the game plan and says, okay, ball out, ball out, ball out, ball out. Kyler saying, no, we need to get the ball down the field. And that led to things. So because he was given the latitude to do it and was not reined in, of course, with that firm belief in himself, he's going to do that. But now he was given some good direction and coaching. I thought that he would thrive under Jonathan Gannon. We still need to see more, but I think the mentality that Gannon has for compete, 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 I think that resonates in Kyler's soul to do exactly what he, to become the type of player that everyone believed he could be.
Yeah, and that's where it's at. That's where it's at right now, right? Is that there just seems to be a mutual respect and belief in each other. I will say this too. I think for Kyler, and I'm not overly familiar, so I don't want to state this as fact, but I'm not overly familiar with Lincoln Riley. I don't know if you are either, with his personality or things, but he seems like a generally more positive type of guy as well. It doesn't surprise me that's who Kyler thrives under, right? Call it entitlement, call it, you know, not, call it being babied, call it whatever you want. I don't really care. But the generation now, and I can say this as a coach.
Yes, we're getting to the generation. Rah!
Yeah.
This is where we are now, old men on our lawns right now.
Yeah. But I can say this as a coach, genuinely, is that the way I coach my soon-to-be 18-year-old and the way I coach my now 12-year-old when they were the same age is vastly different. And I'm getting the same results. It's not like it's not like when I was coaching my older son that we were a bad team. We were still competing and winning championships. But I've had to learn that there are so many kids now that cannot take coaching or direction, that when it comes from a place of negativity, and again, whether you and I agree with that, I mean, because how we were raised, you know, whether it was in the classroom or on the sports field, how we were raised by that generation of men was not, it was never like, hey, you made a mistake, it's okay, you'll go get them next time. It was, what the hell are you doing? You know, we've been over this 100 times. How can you make that mistake? And that's just, you know, there was not a lot of soft parenting. I think, is that what they call it now? Soft parenting?
Gentle parenting.
Thank you. And genuinely, and I'm saying this from a place of I've learned, and so it wouldn't surprise me if that's how Kyler responds more. It's not that you're not, like you said, it's not that you're not asking them to compete. It's that you're putting them in competition with a positive spin of like, let's go work, right? Like, not a fear of failure, because if I fail, I've let everybody down. But instead you're going, hey, like, that mistake was okay because we can do this now, or now we know this for next time. And that's how you have to learn it. And again, whether people agree with me or not, I genuinely don't care, because I'm telling you from living it, that is how it works. And it is crazy to see it. I mean, it is crazy to see it, and to see that Kyler responds so well to Gannon, like you said, from all aspects, but especially the competitiveness of what he likes about Gannon. I think that is why you're seeing such a positive outcome. And again, there are a lot of different things that we would like to see Kyler continue to improve on. But if you go back to that Eagles game, there were throws made in that game where you're just like, holy cow. And not even the one that stands out, the James Conner one, right? But there were throws made on those last, in that second half, that you're like, he's starting to feel comfortable and get it. And if it takes that type of positive, active, you know, competitive environment, then so be it. And again, because we're covering the team, so we've seen the different egos and men involved in how they coach, and you know, do you or I think that Kyler would thrive under Bruce Arians? Not sure. I'm not sure he could publicly be called out. I'm not sure he could deal with how Arians react or his off the cuff demeanor at times. Not that he couldn't be coached hard by him, but I'm just not sure with the accountability board and, you know, those type of public things that Kyler would thrive in that situation. We know DJ Humphries didn't, right?
No, he was not a fan of BA.
And so you know, there's a good chance, and we'll never know, but there was a good chance that Kyler wouldn't either, because it just wouldn't fit. But, and you know, the easiest way to look at it is that you have probably the greatest coach of all time in Bill Belichick, right? That is just, I mean, he's not the same guy. They're not the same team. And it's because a lot of guys can't play in that. And now you're seeing, I don't know if you saw that the other day, but now you're seeing like kind of the mask come off from ex-players too, right? Where people are taking shots at Belichick and things like that. And it's just, we're in a stage where a guy like Kyler probably needs a coach like Gannon to reach his full potential. If it's going to happen. And we've seen it with, you know, that in Gannon's personality, let me put it this way, you know, I'm not saying he is, but Gannon's personality is very similar to Andy Reid's, right? Like, they're very jovial. They're very positive. They're very player oriented in all that they do. And, you know, sometimes it can go too far, and we'll see if that's the case with the Chiefs and kind of how they're faltering this season. But for the most part, it just seems like guys like Reed, guys like Shanahan, guys like McVay, that they are the ones turning into the best coaches. Well, I mean, Reed's been one, but they're the best coaches in the league, and their personalities are very similar to Gannon's, right? They're that personality of upbeat positivity, that plays well a lot of times. Whether or not you and I agree with it, doesn't matter. Does it? Like, it genuinely doesn't matter whether or not you and I think that's the best way to do things. But it is how it seems like Kyler's getting by, and what's making him buy in as much as he has, and vice versa, what is exciting Gannon about it, because he's seeing a guy for the first time since year three really buy into what's happening.
Yeah, it's been, and it just gives us the confidence moving forward. We already have discussed the reasons why it wouldn't make sense to move on for Kyler. But now, and we do have to point out, Cliff Kingsbury did say that Josh Rosen is our guy. And
100%.
And Jonathan Gannon also said, I'm not going to be anywhere but here, referring to the Eagles in the offseason. And he said to Josh Dobbs he wants to be traded. So coaches say whatever. But Gannon's actions also suggest a complete belief in Kyler Murray. And if there's one thing that Gannon has also preached is and talked about since being hired is the need to be in alignment from top to bottom in the organization. So if he is publicly stumping for Kyler Murray, it's because that is the belief in the building, because he's not going to, philosophically, he's not going to say those things publicly if that isn't also the belief in the building.
Right. And that's the thing, is I really truly do believe that this is the most aligned we have seen things since 2013 through 2016 run. I'll forego 2017 because I think people started to have their own agendas at that point. But that 2013 to 2016 run, where it seemed like, for better or worse, BA and Steve Keim were on the same page about what was needed on the team, what they needed to do going forward, and the best way to attack it. And we'll see if that works itself out in the long term, because, you know, we're seeing a lot of high praises and a lot of hope giving positivity for a 4-12 team at the end of the day. I mean, that's what's funny to, like, just kind of go back and think about, right, is that all of this about a 4-12 team.
It's true, but it's a 4-12 team that's going in the right direction. And with that, we'll wrap up this edition of the Rise Up Series podcast, Best of Cardinals Talk on the Web. This is episode 503, and that is Seth Cox, and I'm Jess Root. So you can expect to hear us again later this week as we will do our preview picks and prop bet show about the Seattle Seahawks season finale. I'll see if I can't also get someone on to preview the game as well. Someone from Seahawks Wire, perhaps Tim Weaver, who was on earlier this season, or Cole Musgrove, who also has done that for us. But with that, that's Seth Cox. I'm Jess Root. Thanks for listening. As always, we'll be back in a couple days.
Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up C-Red podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise up, Red Sea, be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up, Sea Red.